Good morning. May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, and honored Justices. My name is Jeffrey Wright, counsel for the appellant, Missouri Department of Transportation. As you know already, this is an appeal that arises out of a workers' compensation claim alleging a mental injury. This Court should reverse and deny the decision of the Court of Appeals Eastern District because there is insufficient, competent, substantial, and objective evidence to support a conclusion that the employee suffered a compensable mental injury due to work-related stress. There are three points I would like to make. One, the Eastern District mischaracterized our reliance on Williams v. DePaul. Section 287.020.1, the aggravation clause, does not abrogate this case as the court held. This case involves Section 287.120.8, which is the mental injury portion of the statute. It does not, as the abrogation clause says, interpret the meaning of or definition of any of the specific terms that that section is concerned with. Accident, occupational disease, arising out of, and in the course of. Those terms are in that statute, in the mental stress statute, but this case does not interpret them. No abrogation actions were directed toward this statutory section. No cases that were mentioned in that section were mentioned in Williams v. DePaul or relate to Williams v. DePaul. Now, Williams v. DePaul does have a problem. It was decided under liberal interpretation section 287.800 of the revised statutes of Missouri. In the days that it was decided, the courts of this state interpreted workers' compensation claims liberally with an eye toward the claimant. When the 2005 amendments to the statute occurred, that was changed. It became a strict construction statute.
And how does strict or liberal construction affect statutory analysis if the statute is unambiguous? Should it have any effect on that?
It won't have much effect, but it may affect the application of that statute. Strict construction.
If something's unambiguous, do we have any discretion in interpreting
it? You have some, I believe you have some discretion to define terms in the statute.
If the statute defines them, we can define them differently?
I don't think you can define them differently if the statute defines them.
Well, back to Judge this question. Why do we need to resort to any rules of construction if there's no ambiguity?
I don't think the rules of construction, if it's completely unambiguous, which I don't believe a lot of statutes are, but if it's completely unambiguous, then you probably don't have to do a lot of construction.
So is this statute ambiguous or unambiguous?
I think there's some ambiguity in this statute for sure, especially when you talk about the various definitions. The legislature didn't provide us with definitions of many of the terms in this statute. Another aspect of interpreting the statute is looking at the legislative intent as well. So I think that you have some leeway to look at the statute.
But normally you get the legislative intent from the plain and ordinary language, and you don't consider what their intent might have been beyond that. So again, for that to be a part of the interpretation of the statute, there has to be some ambiguity.
And I agree with you, Your Honor, and I think that the ambiguity, again, in this statute, 287.120.8, lies in some of the terms of it, including objective, which the legislature didn't provide us with any definition of what they mean by objective.
What's ambiguous about the word objective?
It's not, as it stands alone, it's not ambiguous, but we don't know from the plain language what the real meaning is. And as we look at the decisions that happened in this case, the Industrial Commission came up with one definition of objective, and then the Court of Appeals came up with another one, very different.
And your definition of it would be that you look at what is unusual and extraordinary from the point of view of other people in the line of work of the plaintiff, of the employee.
I think that's one way to look at it. The point I was going to make about Williams v. DePaul, I think we were mischaracterized in saying that we relied on it. We wanted to bring it up because we believe that if you look at this statute and use the plain language and come up with a definition of objective that everyone is happy with, that then evidence such as similarly situated employees could still satisfy that requirement, could still be.
But where do you get that from the statute is really what my question ends up coming to. Is it says you use an objective standard, but it sounds like to me you're saying we should use a subjective standard.
The subjective portion of it would be, as the Court of Appeals said, individual perceptions, feelings, and intentions of the subject, which would be the claimant or employee in this matter. I think that the legislative intent of this is to say that we need something more. They are looking for something beyond just what the plaintiff or claimant says.
Sure, I understand.
Well,
but you're,
the statute that was interpreted in Williams and this statute is exactly the same, right?
Correct.
And there's nothing in the 2005 that abrogated anything, that abrogated that case or any of the statutes that are in there, right?
That is correct.
So what, if anything, makes this case different than Williams said? It's the same words in the same statute.
Yeah, I think there are some similarities. And again, I think that the idea of the similarly situated employee, which has been kicked around a lot in this case, is something that is still compelling for this type of case. It's easy evidence to obtain. It's easy to talk to another employee. It's easy to maybe get several employees. In this case, our claimant, our employee, was a maintenance supervisor. She ran a crew for 20 years. She had a lot of employees working with her who ostensibly would have been at these accident scenes with her, who could have been brought into this and asked about the type of stress they may have felt, or what they witnessed, or what they may have witnessed that she did.
And where do you get that from the statute, that we look at similarly situated employees?
It was suggested by Williams.
I understand. I'm not asking about the case. I'm asking
and
about
the. And my point
statute.
Is, I think that is external, to use the definition of the district court, excuse me, the Eastern District. That's externally verifiable phenomena.
But where in the statute do we get the authority to look at that? Because
and
that's the purpose of this discussion of can we?
Well, doesn't this?
Are we adding things to the statute by saying, oh, it doesn't say similarly situated; it says objective standards and actual events. You're saying of similarly situated employees. I understand why you think that might be a good standard, but is it one that's set out in the statute?
It's not set out in the statute.
So aren't we adding or creating ambiguity? Adding components to the statutory test that aren't there by doing that. Whether or not a good policy is a different question.
I think we're helping remove some ambiguity. I think it's good evidence. I don't say that it's absolutely required. I think there are a lot of different ways you can get that evidence, but I think you can still utilize that evidence. It's easy to get, but I'm not saying that this statute absolutely says you must have similarly situated employees. My point of this is I think you can utilize that evidence under these standards, and it's helpful.
Okay.
Okay. Before the sentence that talks about objective standards, it says mental injury resulting from work-related stress that does not rise out of the course. Let's see. Work-related stress does not arise out of the course and scope of employment unless it is demonstrated that the stress is work-related and extraordinary and unusual.
Yes.
Why doesn't that language suggest that we're talking about the particular type of work and it being extraordinary or unusual as it relates to the particular type of work that you're doing?
Yes, that's definitely what the statute is talking about. In this case, mental injury was established. We have no doubt it was established by the physicians. Work-relatedness was established as well. Extraordinary and unusual is a tricky one because there is no real testimony from anyone other than Dr. Stillings about extraordinary and unusual, those standards. There's a story that was told by the claimant, certainly horrific accidents that she witnessed over a 20-year period. But I think the statute demands that you have to look at other evidence. You have to have corroborating evidence to go along with that to determine whether it's extraordinary or unusual. Let me ask it this way.
It seems to me that extraordinary and unusual has to mean as to everybody, or it has to mean as to other people in your line of work. It has to mean one or the other, right?
I think.
I mean, isn't the question which does it really mean? Does it Because there are all sorts of jobs that one might think are more stressful than other types of jobs as it relates to mental injury. So isn't the real question here, does the statute mean extraordinary and unusual to the world and all jobs, or the type of jobs that you chose to do?
My understanding is the type of job that the claimant is doing. That's the focus of this.
And so is it a job that creates extraordinary and unusual stress?
The job itself, not necessarily, but some of the stressors surrounding the job could create that extraordinary and unusual stress.
Let's go back to the objective standard. I'd say hundreds of cases that say an objective standard is a reasonable person standard in the same circumstances. Why on earth would this be any different than a reasonable person standard, which does not mean you bring in co-employees to find out what they think?
Because the way I look at it is it's a high burden. I don't think that just saying a reasonable person is your objective standard. This statute has established a very high burden of proof for the
Well, a high burden of proof may come from something, but if it uses objective has a clear meaning and a test that has been applied in legal circumstances that means a reasonable person test.
And I think part of the problem with that is, first of all, I think that if I go back to my law school education, it goes back to negligence cases rather than a case like this. Also, I think when you look at this statute and you talk about objective and the legislative intent, which is to create this high burden of proof, I think you're looking at some other evidence. And that's what the case is, even if
But where's the high burden of proof you're talking about?
We're talking about extraordinary and unusual. Uh-huh. You're talking about objective standards. You're talking about actual events. That's all a higher burden of proof than normal workers' comp cases.
Well, it's particular proof. It's not to change anyone's burden. It changes what you have to prove.
Right. It's a higher burden. Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, when you look at that, I think, I think what the legislature was looking for is something more. They're looking for reliable corroborative evidence. If we use a reasonable man standard, then I don't think we really get to what the legislature is
looking for. If they intended a special meaning of the word objective, which has longstanding meaning in the law, wouldn't they have defined it differently? And if they didn't, wouldn't we assume the normal meaning of that word is used?
Yeah. Well, and that's the problem that we have, is that we wish they had defined it and they didn't define it, so we have to come up with something.
Well, why not the normal meaning of the word under the law?
And a normal meaning of the word under the law is one possible solution, definitely.
Okay.
Your time is up. We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Joy Hudson, and I represent Respondent Treasurer. I'd like to briefly state that Williams was actually a case of first impression. And in the absence of applicable Missouri case law, both the Labor and Industrial Relations Commission and the court properly consulted law in other jurisdictions to determine an objective standard for work-related stress. And as has already been pointed out, the language at issue today in Williams, the language at issue today remains the same as the language in Williams. And the legislature still has not defined what objective standards and actual events must be used to ascertain whether the work-related stress was extraordinary and unusual. And in Williams, they found, as we know, the proper comparison was to compare an employee's work-related stress with the stress encountered by employees having similar positions, regardless of employer, with a focus on evidence of the stress encountered by similarly situated employees. And I think this is important because Section 287.067, which is the occupational disease section, says that only paid firefighters and paid peace officers can establish a psychological stress claim if a direct causal relationship is established. So they are not held to the prevailing factor standard in a typical Missouri workers' compensation case. Section 287.120.10 goes even further and says firefighters' ability to receive benefits for psychological stress shall not be diminished by provision 287.120.8, which is the extraordinary and unusual standard.
So they don't have to prove that.
No.
And they do have to prove things by objective and standards and actual events. But you heard the discussion earlier. Where does the similarly situated employee come in? Is that a judicial gloss? And if so, is it justified by the language in the statute?
I think that it is justified because extraordinary and unusual for employees other than firefighters, something that they have to prove and has never been.
But that relates to the job, not to this subjective individual.
Because there are a lot of jobs that you and I would find to be extraordinary and unusual. If we look at...
Why didn't they say the amount of work stress shall be measured by what's normal in that field of work or something, if that's what they intended? This, by saying it's objective, seems to suggest it's not that, which you might otherwise think from just the first sentence.
I think because you also have to take whether the job is extraordinary and unusual and objective. So whether something is extraordinary and unusual using objective standards and events could mean very, very different things to very different people depending on what their background is. And if a firefighter is the only job that the legislature has determined that in and of itself that job alone is extraordinary and unusual, I think if we then say, well, let's have a preschool teacher decide if the ER doctor's job was extraordinary and unusual, or vice versa, the ER doctor deciding if the preschool teacher's job is extraordinary and unusual, we're going to get very, very different decisions. No one's going to have any knowledge on whether something's extraordinary and unusual when they first see it. And we don't always know that, but we need to be able to analyze cases and say, what is our standard? And we don't know. No one has told us. The legislature's not seen to define the word objective in this instance. They have defined objective in other portions of the statute.
Why is the legislature deemed to have accepted Williams way back in 96 and forward? It's been there, right?
Right.
In 05, they made lots of changes, mentioned some cases that this court in the Eastern District by name, saying we don't prefer that definition, but they didn't mention Williams and they didn't change this statute. So why shouldn't we assume that they meant it the way that we've interpreted it until they change it?
I think we should. I think we should affirm Williams. I think the legislature has had ample time. They've had plenty of time to say we don't like Williams.
And you're taking, this is for the second injury fund, is that
yes.
correct? So and that's a different position. You agree in that sense with the employer on this issue?
That's correct. Right. Yes. I think if we agree with the commission's reasoning in defining the objective standards and events, we would be inviting many other jobs into the same category as firefighters, where it just becomes assumed that that job is extraordinary and unusual. And as I mentioned, the very nature of many jobs is extraordinary and unusual to a great portion of our population. I think your job would be considered extraordinary and unusual to a great portion of our population.
The stress has to be extraordinary and unusual, the job.
Well, and that's what I think we're going to determine if we go with the commission's decision. I think the commission's decision is looking at the stressors in a way that is allowing us to funnel a lot of jobs and say they're extraordinary and unusual under 287.120.8, when in fact, that was not the intent. The intent was only one category of job is.
Well, it's the stress.
Determined.
It's not the category of job.
Correct. But if we're looking at the stress of an ER doctor as compared to the stress of someone who, like I said, works in a preschool, is the stress extraordinary and unusual? And if we use the reasonable person standard, that preschool teacher might say, "Oh my goodness, resuscitating someone and bringing them back to life, that's extraordinary and unusual stress." Whereas for an ER doctor, that might just be the second person they did that to for that, you know, that day. So I think we need to have a specific standard that we use in workers' compensation cases under 287.067, and I think that Williams is the correct standard. I would ask that this court affirm Williams, and we also ask that this court reverse the commission's finding that Ms. Mantilla sustained a compensable work injury and that the award of the commission denying benefits from the fund should be affirmed as well. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to first note it's a pleasure to be back here. My last time back here was in 1982 when I was sworn in, so it's been a long time. I'd like at the outset like to make a point, and I'd like to reiterate some of the facts. This is a set of facts that I think is really pretty astonishing. And these were the findings of fact, because there were no indication, no evidence to the contrary. But this is a woman who witnessed a boy burning in a car and saw the boy screaming as he was dying, who saw a strange color of a man who was asphyxiated, who was examining an accident scene and when walking around accidentally kicked a decapitated head. Someone who witnessed someone jump from a bridge and hit the ground and saw the person striking the ground. This is a situation of someone here who's seen a coworker whose skull has been crushed, who's seen an individual who has been impaled by a guardrail and saw the look in her eyes as she had her hands on the wheel as she laid there lifeless. This is a woman who basically has witnessed one horrific event after another horrific event. And the question of what is objective, I think, basically comes down to what would the reasonable man think? And what is objective is what would the typical person think when looking at a situation like this?
And is it the typical person what they would think when looking, if they experienced that, if the average person experienced it? Or is it whether that's an extraordinary, unusual stress for the job that the person is doing?
It's our position that the legislature abrogated the similarly situated standard, so it would be based upon the reasonable person.
Well, we'll forget about abrogation and not, and prior cases right. And not. Look at the statute, and what does it tell us? Just reading the words of the statute.
Looking at the statute, the standard is extraordinary and unusual stress, and then we look at it from objective means. And when we look at what the Court of Appeals has said, and we look at what the Commission has said, what they've essentially done is going to the dictionary to determine, well, essentially, what is objective? When we're standing back, I think, to use an example, if we were looking at an individual who had a mouse crawl at their workplace, and as a result, they just completely were overcome by stress and had to be treated, and then we would have to look subjectively. Well, what made that person react that way? Maybe they had some childhood experience or something. Objective is something that we can stand back and look at, and the typical person can look at that and basically make a judgment. And I would note that I believe most people, when they look at these horrific facts, I've run into very few people who've read about my case who've come up to me and said, I don't think that was a big deal. Well, why would kicking a decapitated head or seeing a boy burning alive in a car, why would that affect someone?
Let me ask you this question. If you'd have made this claim in 2004, would it have been successful?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would like to note that, because what we did is we provided testimony by Linda Mantilla, and she basically stated that her particular area that she worked in was a high urban area that involved a lot of traffic accidents and a lot of fatalities. I think basically combined with that, and we compare it to a case that was pre-2005, in the Cardinal case, they talked about harsh language. She testified that there was harsh language and that her ex-husband had basically assigned her with greater workloads. Well, at that time, that testimony was found to be sufficient. We believe that her testimony also is just corroborated by common sense and the facts. Obviously, there were a lot of fatalities and accidents and dismemberments just based on the number of cases that she was able to recount herself.
What is meant by extraordinary and unusual?
Extraordinary and unusual, I think we have to look at it in a sense of what its opposite is. It's something that isn't an everyday occurrence. It's not something that typically that someone walks back past, goes through life, and basically doesn't pay attention or isn't affected by. It's something that stands out. I think extraordinary means a really high level. I think unusual means that it's not something that's commonplace. I think when we put those two words together and we look at the statute, there's been some suggestion somehow that if Williams is overruled, that the standards are going to be lax. But the standards are already extraordinary and unusual, which is a very, very high bar. But our belief is that if there's ever been a case that's met such a high bar, it would be this case with the number of things that this woman went through. In fact, appellant even used the word horrific himself to describe what she had gone through here. We believe that when the abrogation clause also, when it was written up in 2005, basically it called, it basically referred specifically to arising out of and in the course of cases. And the strict construction statute as well basically said that the statute should be construed strictly. And as part of that, cases interpreting that means that should be given no broader application than is warranted by plain and unambiguous terms. And in the case of Templemeyer, the court found that it presumes nothing that is not expressed. We believe that the abrogation clause basically abrogated the findings and the holdings in Williams. And we note that the Williams case wasn't specifically cited in Section 800, but even though it wasn't cited, there were no cases cited in Section 800. What they referred to as a particular type of case was cited. I would also note that with regard to the firefighters case, I don't think that that's a fair comparison. The firefighters, as we look at those cases, they don't have to prove extraordinary and unusual. All they have to do is use the standard of prevailing factor. So they're put in sort of a privileged position versus some of the other people in jobs in terms of they were singled out by statute, and they don't have that standard.
As Judge Fisher's questions kind of got to this point, too, extraordinary and unusual implies compared to the usual and the non-extraordinary. And is that the usual and non-extraordinary for that work, or is it for the average person? Because if it's the average person, wouldn't every day of this person's work be extraordinary and unusual?
Well, I don't think so. I think what we would look at is, I do believe, and I guess I'll try to answer it this way, because extraordinary and unusual, it's a hard thing because we're defining it and we're using other words to try to define it. But I think essentially what we're looking at is, we're looking at a situation here where those particular words essentially are describing something that is not commonplace, something out of the ordinary. And what we run into when we apply
that's not our question. Extraordinary as compared to what? To the other people in this job or all jobs?
Your Honor, our position is that we believe that what this does is increase an even playing field. We believe all jobs.
What's the answer to the question?
I believe all jobs, Your Honor.
Okay. She has to prove that that the stress is work-related.
Yes.
Does that mean that it's work-related to her work or to anyone's work?
I believe that it would be anyone's work. I believe that
she could show that her stress is work-related by showing that stress is related to the work of a construction worker.
I believe after the statute was abrogated, I think basically the standard
work is related has to be her work, because what you always have to prove, things arise out of your work.
Right. There's uncontroverted testimony that that's the case. I believe what we've come up with, and I'll put this another way, I believe we now have a human being standard. What would be considered for a reasonable person, a reasonable human being?
Or do we look at the objective standard says a reasonable person in all the circumstances, and we always look at all the circumstances, among which are your job, but also any other circumstances that may be relevant. But a reasonable person standard always takes into account the situation in which the person finds themselves, part of which is the person's job, and part of which may be other factors.
I believe in a sense it would seem that you could take into account the job to the degree that there could be something that's very routine to someone in a profession who's trained because they have experience with something and they're able to handle something that someone else who's not in that position, if for example, if I had to perform an emergency tracheotomy, it might be something that would be extraordinary to me, but it might be an everyday occurrence for a physician. But at the same time, I believe that the standard essentially evens the bar. Otherwise, what we have is we basically have a lot of different workers' comp laws. And when I compare and contrast one case, when I look at the Carnal case where they looked at harsh language and extra work assignments as meeting the standard of extraordinary stress under the old law, and I look at kicking a decapitated head or seeing a child burn alive, seeing a suicide, and we compare that, I think what we're looking at now is we start to lose our standards. We start to have a particular, every workplace has a new law, has a law that applies to them. I think as a result, then employers are unable to determine when a case is compensable and when it's not. And I think the other thing is we're abandoning people then who would be the very people who would need our help the most, the ones
your,
who are at risk.
Your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, why couldn't she prevail even if the standard was extraordinary and unusual for people in her line of work? Because this certainly, a person could reasonably conclude that these facts were extraordinary and unusual even for somebody in that line of work.
It's possible, but the way I look at this case is we didn't have evidence of that in this case. We have her story, subjective. We have a statute that talks about objectivity, doesn't talk about subjectivity. We have
What evidence should they have adduced?
Well, again, we did have some evidence contrary to the fact that it's extraordinary and unusual. There are two ways to look at it. One is Dr. Stillings said in his testimony he didn't think, although he thought she had some work-related stress, a small amount of work-related stress that he could identify from objective testing, he did not believe it was, quote, extraordinary and unusual. And the basis of his opinion in that regard was that he had treated and met with many different similarly situated employees who worked on the highway, not only in Missouri, but also in Illinois.
Does the statute include the language, the amount of work stress shall be measured by objective standards and actual events?
Actual events as well, correct. And there was her testimony that this occurred. There was no corroborating testimony, again, that occurred.
You don't need corroborating testimony, do you?
Well, the way I look at the statute, again, is
I think
that the statute is asking for some corroboration to make sure that this is
looking for reliability. What language in the statute supports that?
I think that could be implied from reading the statute. I think that they're looking for reliability because it's mental
injury. Has a case required corroboration of an injured person's testimony any time in the past? So you would ask us to add a new requirement that no case has ever required?
There aren't any cases like that. But again, this is a statute that there aren't a lot of cases on and hasn't been interpreted very often. When you look at her testimony is that this happened to me, even though there were 14 specific events she talked about, she said it was over 1,000 times. She also said people who worked for MoDOT in the maintenance supervisor position experienced this all the time. These were common occurrences to her. She also, when each of these occurrences occurred, she did not seek medical treatment. She went through a 20-year career and then went and sought medical treatment. And I think that indicates that
occupational disease, isn't that often the case that you don't have someone, they don't get carpal, every time they do something, they don't go and get treatment for carpal tunnel.
When you look
it accumulates over time.
Yes, Your Honor, when you look at this as an occupational disease, that's correct. I almost look at this as a separate type of injury. I think that when you set this aside in its own statutory section, in the employer liability section, it has its own little piece there, 287.120, 8, and 9, you're saying that mental injuries are different. They are different, they're highly subjective, and we need some reliable way to evaluate these types of injuries so that we get it right. And that's what I think the legislature is saying.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.
Thank you.